They're ripping my ship to shreds, he seethes, when I find that bastard. There aren't words for what I'll do. He's declared war.
I think you did that when you attacked the Mydassan prince and took him prisoner. If you think this is bad, imagine the entire might of the Golden Army devoted to hunting you down. Talis narrows his eyes. What do they call it when someone attacks a member of one of the royal families? Ah, yes. My smile could cut through flesh. Treason of humanity. Is it still the drowning they go for? Talis's face goes slack at the mention of it. The last punishment was long before my time, but sirens still tell stories. Humans who took arms against royalty, breaking the pact of peace among the kingdoms. They were anchored into the ocean and left for my kind, but no siren attacked. Instead, they watched the traitors lose their breath and clutch at their throats. Then, in their final moments, approached so that the humans could drown in fear. According to my mother, it was only when the humans' hearts pumped for the final time that the sirens ripped them from their chests. From the look on Talis's face, he's heard the same nightmarish tales. He draws his sword in a clumsy arc and presses the blade to my cheek.
What do you care? Talis whispers. He left you here, didn't he?
He says it like I should feel betrayed, but nothing in the accusation stings. Elian left because I told him to, and he would have stayed if I had asked. He would have died, perhaps, if I would have let him. But I didn't. I salvaged some small part of myself that I forgot existed, a part I was so sure my mother had gutted from me. And I let him go. Could we continue this conversation after you kill me? I ask. Talis strokes my cheek with his blade. Then, before I have time to flinch, he lifts the sword into the air and brings it swiftly down. I look at my freed hands, and the cleanly sliced rope falls to my feet.
I like my women with a little fight, Talis purrs. Let's see how much of one you put up.
I don't waste time on a smile before I bare my nails to claws. Whatever Talis expects, it's not for me to try to tear his heart out. Like a vulture, I swoop down and scratch until my arms feel heavy. His chest, his eyes, anything I can get my hands on. When he pushes me off, I barely stay on the ground for a second before I'm on him again. I'm an animal, slicing my teeth into his delicate human flesh. I can taste him in my mouth, acrid, a strange mix of metal and water. I bite harder until he tears me from his arm and a slice of his skin goes with me.
You filthy whore!
He screams. I wonder how much I resemble the flesh eater now, with a piece of Rycroft inking the corner of my lips and a smile like the devil goddess who made us all. I swipe my tongue across my lips, snarling as his filthy blood clots in the edges of my teeth. Talis strides over to me, each footstep like thunder against the decrepit floorboards. When he reaches me, he hoists me up by the ruffles of my dress and smashes me into the wall. His legs pin mine in place, knees digging into my thighs. He slams my face to the side with the heel of his palm, and my cheek scrapes against a twisted nail.
I'm going to make you pay for that, he says,
breath warm in my ear.
Sure you are.
I shift my hips into place, keeping my hands steady as I reach under the fabric of his cloak. But first, I would appreciate it if you didn't get your blood all over me. As soon as I feel the knife hilt under his clothes, I pull my hand back and then lurch it violently forward. My wrist twists to the left, and Talis blinks. When I lurch my hand upward, he swallows a choked and ragged sound. His hands drop from my clothes, and he stumbles backward. I slink down the wall and let out a breath. Misdirection, Elian said. Be too quick for them to notice. I look at Talus, his demon eyes and bone-gray skin, the look of fear and surprise that rolls over him like a sea storm. And the knife, his own knife, spearing his gut. It wasn't hard to lift. Apparently it's difficult to notice someone stealing a weapon from your waistband when they also happen to be tearing their teeth through your skin. The blade is so deep that the handle barely surfaces through his shirt. It takes a moment before he falls. Seconds of him frowning and gasping before his head finally hits the floor. I stand over his body and swallow. There's a hollowness in my chest, and the rush that usually comes with death is replaced by a deep pit that sits beside my erratically beating heart. This is the first kill I've made since becoming human, and somehow I thought it wouldn't matter. But there's blood all over me, and Talus's face is slack, and I don't know why, but I'm shaking. I look down at him, and all I can see is Krestel, dying over the sound of Kalia's cries. My hands so wet with her blood, a promise begged between us. Become the queen we need you to be. I close my eyes and wait for the moment to pass, hope that it will, or else I might just go crazy in this cabin. It doesn't make sense for me to think of her now. It's not like Talus is the first kill I've made since. I squeeze my fists and feel the blood cloy under my nails. But Krestel was the start of it, the one my mother used to pull me over to her edge. As a human, I could pretend I had some kind of clean slate if I wanted to. At least for a little while. But not now. Not anymore. I'm a killer in every life. I open my eyes, and when I look back down, Talus is Talus again, and my aunt's face returns to a memory. I sigh in relief and then squint as something shines in the corner of my eye. In the growing sun, I catch the string of metal around Talus's neck. The light blinks from it like a tiny star fighting to stay ablaze. Unsteadily, I crouch down beside the pirate's body and pull back his collar. The Peggy's necklace is still latched around him, the key to freeing the eye. I smile and twist the clasp free, careful, as though I might wake the sleeping pirate, and then pocket the stolen artifact. When the door to the cabin crashes open, I jolt, my shoulders tense, fingernails ready to become weapons once more. Elian doesn't even glance at Talus Rycroft. He crosses the room toward me, eyes bright and so green and flickering with relief. His hair is swept in every direction, ruffling across his forehead, streaking his face. His shirt is torn, but I breathe a sigh when I see there are no new injuries. Just dirt and the splatters of gunpowder. I don't think about whether I'm relieved because I still need him, if I'm going to overthrow my mother, or whether it's something else entirely. Elian's knife is secured in his belt, the magic of it still so strong to me. And in his hand is a sword, his sword, gold and ash glimmering against the shattered glass. When he reaches me, he throws it to the floor and braces my shoulders. His smile is like nothing I have ever seen. I say the first thing I can think of, mirroring his words to me from Idilio. I'm pretty sure I got rid of you already. Elian's cheeks dimple and he casts a look over his shoulder. Kai, Madrid, and Tarik are gathered in a tightly grouped line behind him. They came. Not just for their captain, but for the stowaway. The strange girl they found floating in the middle of the ocean. They came for me. When he turns his back to me, his eyes flicker over my face. His lips tense to a thin line as he notices the scrapes burning into my cheek. The blood that covers me. So much of it my own, and so much of it not mine at all. What are you doing here? I ask. He shrugs. What I do best. Getting on my last nerve?
Saving you,
he replies, picking up his sword.
This is the second time. Not that I'm counting.
It's the third, actually, if we count how he pushed me from Rycroft's path on the deck of the ship. Elian may not be counting, but I am. I can't believe you came back for me, I say. I don't bother to keep the gratitude from my voice.
Elian taps his belt where his knife sits happily. I actually came back for this, he says. Rescuing you was mostly an afterthought.
I level a glare. I don't need rescuing.
For the first time, Elian glances down to the body sprawled across the decaying floor. It's like he only just realizes that the leader of the infamous Zapper, kidnapper of pirates and princes alike, is bleeding out by his feet.
Remind me not to get on your bad side, Elian says.
Too late. He grins. He's still grinning when I see Rycroft's head rise from the floorboards. The pirate's hand is at his waist in barely any time at all, and when he lifts it into the air, I'm surprised to see that the pistol is as black as squid ink.
Just as Elian turns his head, as his crew lurches forward in panic, a shot fires out. It's not the first time I've heard a gun fired, but the sound seems louder. It shudders through my bones and drums in beat with my heart. Everything is a rush of sounds, the smell of gunpowder and the awful scream of warning that shoots from Kai's lips. And then Elian, the way his smile drops when he notices the dread in my eyes. 3 life debts. It's almost a reflex when I push him out of the bullet's path. There is an instant quiet that blankets the room. A fragment of a second when the world seems to have lost all sound. And then I feel it. The pain of scorching metal tearing through my human skin.
29. Elian. I died once, and I haven't been able to do it again since. I was 13 at the time, or some other number just as lucky. About a mile out from the Medassin shore, there's a lighthouse on a small stretch of floating meadow. The sea wardens use it as a vantage point while my friends and I used it to prove our bravery. The idea was to swim the mile, touch the soaking tufts of grass, and stand on top like the proud victor. The reality was not drowning. Nobody ever made the swim because anybody stupid enough to consider it was too young, and anybody old enough had learned the usefulness of boats. But the fact that nobody had done it, that if I could, I'd be the first, only made the idea more appealing. And the roar of my brain begging me not to die turned to a quiet whisper. I made it to the lighthouse, but I didn't have the strength to pull myself up. I did, however, have the strength to scream before my mouth filled with water, and I let the gold wash me away. I'm not sure how long I was dead because my father refuses to speak of such things, and I never asked my mother. It felt like an eternity. After, the world must have felt particularly sorry for me, because of all the crazy deadly things I've done since, which far outweigh a mile-long swim, I'm still alive, untouched by another brush of mortality, made invincible somehow by that first fatality. The moment the bullet whizzes through the air, and I feel Lyra's cold hands at my back pushing me to the ground, I'm angry at that. At my invincibility, my flair for survival while those around me continue dying. No! Madrid screams, pitching forward. She cracks her boot against Rycroft's chin and sends teeth in so many directions I can't focus. Kai grabs her by the waist, holding desperately as she tries to tear herself from his grasp and finish off the pirate. The one who stole her captain. Who may or may not have sold her into slavery. Who just shot a girl right in front of her. Madrid screams and curses, while Lyra makes no sound at all. She frowns, which seems louder, and presses her hand to the hole in her side. Her palm comes away wet and shaking. She looks down at the blood. It doesn't Burn, she says, and then buckles to the floor. I rush to her, skidding underneath her frail body before it cracks onto the wood. I catch her head in my hands and she lets out a choked sound. There's blood. Too much blood. Every time I blink, it seems to pool farther and farther until the entire right side of her dress is soaked through. I lay my hand on her rib and press down. She's right, it's not warm. Lyra's blood is like melted ice running between my fingers. The harder I press, the more she shudders, convulsing as I try to stop any more of the cold seeping from her. Lyra, I say, the word more like a plea than a name. You're not going to die. I resist looking at the wound again, not wanting to for fear that she might actually die, and my last words to her might be a lie, and what a jackass thing that would be. I know, Lyra says. Her voice is steadier than mine, like the pain is nothing. Or at least it's something less than she's felt before. I've still got a mountain to climb. Her head lolls a bit and I steady my hand, propping her up. If she loses consciousness now, there's no knowing if she'll wake up. This evens the score, you know, I say, but I'm still a point up. Lyra shifts. Quick, she says. My fingers are webbed by her blood, shirt tails damp against my hip. Take this to make up for it. She lifts a shaking arm and a small pendant falls from her hand to mine. Bluer than her eyes and far too delicate to hold so much power. The piggy's necklace. She got it. I laugh and consider what smart comment I could make, telling her that it's not really my style or that maybe I already have it in gold. But then Lyra's eyes quiver back and there doesn't seem to be much point in being funny if she isn't the one to hear it. Captain, Madrid yells, Kai's hand still clenched to her waist. She needs a medic. Torek shadows over me, squeezing my shoulder with his mighty hands and bringing me back to reality. I swallow, nod, stand with Lyra far too light in my arms, run away from the dregs of Rycroft's shitty ship, leaving a trail of blood in my wake. Get moving, I shout once I step foot back onto the sod, and blow that ship to hell in our backwash. The sod lurches and my crew jumps into anarchy. They run from one end of the deck to the other, pulling the lines from their winches and recleating the boom, trimming sails and scanning for the wind. I cleave forward, pushing past the ones who stopped dead, noticing the blood-soaked girl in my arms and offering their hand. Ilion, Kai says. You're injured. Let me carry her. I ignore him and turn to Torek. His face is wretched as he stares down at Lyra. She may not have been one of us before, but dying in the line of duty has a way of securing people's loyalty. Make sure the medic is ready, I say, and my first mate nods. Rycroft is slung carelessly over his shoulder, his blood dripping down Torek's back. He's alive, but barely, and if I get my hands on him, then he won't stay that way for long. With Lyra still limp in my arms, I yell for Torek to get a medic, and he throws Rycroft to the floor without hesitation before rushing below decks. Really, we don't have a medic, but my assistant engineer traveled with a placematash circus, and that's close enough. As I carry Lyra toward him, through the twists and tunnels of my ship, I'm caught off guard by the notion that out of all the princes and pirates and killers and convicts, the small boy from a circus is the only one who can help. It seems funny. And I think how Lyra might laugh knowing that a rookie engineer will be stitching her skin back together. What biting comment she would come back with, and how it would sink into me like a perfectly wonderful kind of poison. Like a bullet. I push my way into the cramped room, Kai rushing in behind me. The would-be medic gestures to a table in the middle of the engineering room. Put her down there, he says in a panicked breath, and open her dress. I do as he says and grab my knife. The strange thing is that at first I don't think I can see any more blood gushing from the wound. It seems to all be on her dress and on me. And then when I do see blood, it doesn't seem like enough. Or perhaps it's all already come out. Maybe there just isn't any left. Gods. Kyra coils as I slash open Lyra's dress. Is she going to live? Do you care? I snap back. It isn't his fault, but yelling at Kai feels a little like yelling at myself. And I need to be yelled at right now. Because this is on me. If Lyra dies, then it's on me. I can't believe you came back for me. But I left her first. I don't want her to die, Elian. Kai squeezes my arm, keeping me steady as the fraying parts inside threaten to dismantle me. I never did. Besides, Kai shoves a hand into his pocket and sighs through the next words. She protected you when I couldn't. It looks like a clean shot, the medic says, and I turn, the irony of it gnawing at me. It was a dirty shot through and through. It just scraped her ribs, he says. I have to check no organs were damaged, though. He points a gloved finger at Kai. Don't just stand there shadowing my light, get me some towels. Kai doesn't bristle at the order or argue that we should let Lyra die to be sure she can't betray us. He turns, hurries from the room, and doesn't even waste the time to glare properly. She didn't nick anything important, the medic says. He phrases the last part as an afterthought, but when he turns to me, his eyes are expectant. I'm not sure, I tell him. There was a lot of blood. He shrugs and grabs an instrument that does not look entirely legitimate from a nearby toolbox. Haven't met an engine I couldn't fix yet, he says. The human body's just another machine. He looks at me with assuring eyes. I saved a monkey with a knife wound to the ribs once. There was an accident with a balloon bursting. It's not that different. I think this is supposed to be reassuring. So I nod just as Kai bursts back into the room with a handful of fresh towels. After, we are both ushered back out the way we came, and I don't argue. I'm glad to be sent away so the medic can work, free from staring at Lyra's limp body and thinking about how I've never seen her look so vulnerable, so capable of being finite. I don't give myself a moment to breathe before I walk back onto the deck and toward Rycroft's body. My crew flares their nostrils, waiting to be let loose. Beside me, I sense the rigid way Kai stands, barely able to restrain himself and hoping desperately I don't ask him to restrain the others. That's the thing about my crew. They don't need to be friends. They don't even need to like one another. Being on the sod is the same as being family, and by saving me, Lyra has proven something to Kai. I locked her in a cage and made her barter her way onto my ship, and she saved me all the same, believing that it was the right choice. A life for a life, trust for trust. Talus Rycroft stares at me, and he's not alive enough to make it look menacing. His left eye is closed, a lump stretching out like a mountaintop, and the wounds on his face make his lips indistinguishable. The hole in his stomach bleeds on. What are you going to do with him? Kai asks. His voice is not altogether calm, something unbalanced on those usually carefree tones. He wants revenge as much as I do, and not just for taking his captain, but for the broken girl lying in the dregs of our ship. I don't know. Madrid walks a small pocket knife between her fingers. When it nicks her, she lets the blood drip onto Rycroft's injured leg. He doesn't deserve to live, she says. You don't have to lie to us. One of Rycroft's eyes blink slowly as he comprehends the storm he has created. The young prince in me wants to feel sorry for him, but I keep looking at the half-moons and long serrated lines that crease into his biceps. Wounds made trying to fend him off. Nail marks so similar to the ones along my own chest. I hesitate, caught off guard as a distorted image of the prince's bane flashes across my mind. She could have snapped my neck or done any manner of things to disable me. But she let her claws tear slowly through my chest instead. That was the thing about sirens. They always went straight for the heart. Captain, Madrid says, and I blink away the image. I'm going to find some shark-infested waters, I tell her, regaining my composure, and then drop his favorite appendage in. There is a phlegmatic silence while everyone within earshot considers those words. Rycroft half blinks again. Next time, Kai says, clearing his throat. Lie to us. What about Lyra? Madrid asks. I shrug. Depends on how pleasant she is when she wakes up. I mean, she says, is she really going to be okay? I stare down at Rycroft, and it takes every scrap of strength I have to smile. My crew is not so easily killed. It's a bullshit line, but I need everyone to believe it. I need to believe it myself. I picture Lyra, and it's like I can feel her cold blood dripping through my hands like melted ice. If she dies, then my plan and this entire mission dies with her. More than anything, I'm counting the minutes until our rookie engineer emerges and tells me that everything is fine. That Lyra didn't die for me, and that she can still offer the last piece of the puzzle to free the crystal of Quito from its cage. That maybe, just maybe, I don't need to rip Rycroft into any more pieces.
30. Lyra. I wake, and then immediately wish I hadn't. There's a raw pain in my ribs, like there's a creature gnawing at my skin, and I feel groggy in a way that tells me I've had too much sleep. The room I'm in is as jumbled as my thoughts. I brush my open shirt out of the way and brace my heavily bandaged ribs. My teeth grind against one another as I let my legs swing over the side of the bench. It's a mere second of being upright before the gnawing turns into a bite. There's something about a bullet wound that makes me want to jump out of bed, too. Kai is washing his hands in a nearby sink. It's thick with oil and grease. When he's finished, he shakes the water from his hands and turns to me with a condemning look. This is supposed to be a bed? I ask. He places a wet hand against my forehead, and I resist the urge to retract from the cold. I don't think you're dying now, he says. Was I dying before? He shrugs. Maybe, but the little circus medic fixed you up okay. He even taught me how to dress your wound so he could focus on helping the ship stay afloat. Kai nods to the bandages with a smug look. Pretty perfect, aren't they? My first. Could you not have given me a bed, too? I ask, not failing to notice that someone, I hope Madrid rather than Kai, has also dressed me in something more plain and comfortable than the dress I was in. Madrid fetched you pillows. Kai wipes his hands on a nearby rag. It's the best we could do since moving you wasn't an option. I glance down at the stained sheet draped thinly over me. There's a black velvet pillow where my head was, plush enough for me to have slept comfortably for however long, and a thin oval cushion is pressed into the shape of my feet. It's not exactly fit for a queen, but for a gunshot victim aboard a pirate ship, it might be considered luxurious. How are you feeling? Kai asks, and I smirk. Were you worried? When he doesn't reply, I test my ribs with a deep sigh. Fine, I say. The bandage is tight around my body, and the dressing feels fresh and crisp against my clammy skin. It must have been changed recently, I realize, which means that Kai has been watching over me. I expected Madrid, I tell him. Of all people, I didn't think it would be you. She was here for a while, he says. Longer than a while, actually. I had to send her off to get some sleep before she resorted to stapling her eyes open. He looks down at his hands. She was worried you'd be just another girl who couldn't escape. Escape what? Rycroft, he says, and then shuffles uncomfortably. I'm glad you're awake. The comment isn't as throwaway as he might want it to be. For all the distrust between us, Kai and the rest of the crew risked their lives to come back for me. And while I lay bleeding on their ship, they didn't leave me to sleep in solitude. They stayed. They came for me. And they stayed. "So you trust me now?" I ask.
"You nearly died trying to save Elian."
Kai clears his throat as though it's a struggle to get the words out.
"So, like I said, I'm glad you're awake."
"I'm glad that you didn't kill me while I was unconscious." Kai snorts a smile.
"I like the way you say thank you."
I laugh and then wince. "How long was I asleep?"
"A few days," he tells me. "We had some strong sedatives and we all thought it would be a good idea for you to get some rest."
He grabs the rag from by the sink and passes it uneasily between his hands.
"Listen," he says gingerly. "I know I've given you a hard time, but that's only because Elian seems to like putting himself in death's hands a little too often, and it's my job to stop that from happening whenever I can."
"Like a good bodyguard," I say.
"Like a good friend," he corrects. "And I think taking a bullet for him has earned you a break from me being shitty."
He sighs and throws the rag onto my lap.
"I guess this officially makes you one of us."
I take a moment to process that. The idea that I belong with them on a ship setting sail for everywhere and nowhere. It's what I wanted, isn't it? To gain the crew's confidence so that they wouldn't suspect me. And yet, the instant Kai says it, I don't think about how I've earned trust I plan to break. I think about how different it feels. To be a new kind of soldier, earning loyalty by saving lives instead of destroying them. Fighting a war on the other side.
"I didn't quite hear that apology," I say. "Could you repeat it?"
Kai glares. But it's different than before, lighter. Nothing hostile grazing over it. A smile settles on his face.
"Guess Elian's been teaching you his version of humor," he says.
At the mention of Elian's name, I pause. He promised that he wouldn't come back for me if something went wrong, and then he did it anyway. The moment he freed himself from the restraints and was faced with the opportunity to leave, he didn't want to. I squeeze my eyes shut as my head begins to pound. My entire purpose for being on this ship is to kill him, and when the opportunity came for someone else to do it, I stopped them. I pushed him from the bullet, the same way he pulled me from the ocean, without thinking or weighing up what it could mean or how it might benefit me. I did it because it seemed like the only thing to do, the right thing to do. In my world, Kalia is the sole remnant of my lost innocence. The only proof that there's a tiny part of me I haven't let my mother get her hands on. I don't know why, but Elian has evoked the same feral feeling that used to be reserved only for her. The desire to allow sparks of loyalty and humanity in me to take hold. We're the same, he and I. Just as looking into my cousin's eyes feels like looking into a memory of my own childhood. Being around Elian feels like being around an alternate version of myself. Reflections of each other in a different kingdom and a different life. Broken pieces from the same mirror. There are worlds between us. But that seems more like semantics than tangible evidence of how dissimilar we are. Everything is murkier now. And Elian made it that way in a single second. With an action as easy as breathing. He smiled. Not because I was suffering or bowing or making myself malleable to his every whim and decree like I've done with my mother. He smiled because he saw me, free and alive, and already making my way back to him. I've been so focused on putting an end to my mother's reign that I haven't thought about how I can put an end to her war. Even if I get my hands on the eye, I still planned to take Elian's heart, just as my mother ordered, thinking it would prove something to my kingdom. But what? That I'm the same as her, valuing death and savagery over mercy? That I'll betray anyone, even those who are loyal to me? If I find the eye, maybe it's not just sirens who don't need to suffer anymore, but humans too. Maybe I can stop the age-old grudge that began in death. Be a new kind of queen who doesn't create murderers from daughters. I think of Krestel, shielding Kalia from me and laying down her own life instead. Become the queen we need you to be.
I should get the captain, Kai says, breaking me from my thoughts. I slide from the bench, letting the pain soak through me and then drift away. I gather my footing and focus on this newfound urgency.
No, I tell him, don't. Kai hesitates by the door, his hand already pressing down on the handle.
You don't want him to come?
He asks. I shake my head. He doesn't need to, I say. I'll find him.
31. Elian. Pagos draws near, and with every league the air grows thinner. We feel it each night, our bones creaking with the ship as she sweeps through water that will soon turn to sludge and ice. It doesn't matter how much farther we have, because Pagos is something that is always felt from within. More and more with each fathom, it looms somewhere deep inside. The final part of our quest, where the crystal of Keto waits to be freed. Rycroft is as much a ghost now as he has ever been, hidden below decks with barely enough gauze and meds to stay alive, the minimum necessary to make the journey with us. I haven't been down there, delegating the responsibility to Torek and other members of the crew who can handle him well enough and show restraint even better. Madrid can't be trusted. Not when it comes to one of her own countrymen. Her memories tend to taint her morals, and I can understand it. Kai equally so. There isn't part of me that trusts him to watch over Rycroft and deliver food that isn't laced with poison. And then, more than any of them, there's me. The person I trust the least. Lyra may be alive, but that doesn't put an end to things. The relief has layered over my anger like a film, masking the rage well enough that it can't be seen, though never enough for it to disappear. But whether I go down there or not, Rycroft can sense the fate that awaits him. Even he can hear the slow wolf call of Pagos. From the depths of the crystal cage where Lyra once was and where he will remain until I give him over to the Ice Kingdom. He can catch the whistles in the wind, in a room as dark as his soul. And when we finally arrive, he'll live with them as he rots in a jail as cold as his heart. You're not drinking. Lyra hovers on the ladder steps to the forecastle deck. A blanket is wrapped loosely around her shoulders, and when it slips, she shrugs it higher. I try not to notice the wince as she moves her arm too quickly, stretching her side and jarring the wound. I reach out my hand to pull her up, and the look Lyra gives me is nothing short of poisonous. Do you want me to chop it off? She asks. I keep my hand hovering in the space between us. Not particularly. Then get it out of my face. She pulls herself up the rest of the way and settles next to me. The edges of her blanket skim my arms. It's always so cold these nights. Enough that sleeping with my boots on seems to be the only way to keep my toes. But there's something about being up here, with the stars and the sounds of the sod swimming for adventure. It makes me feel warmer than I ever could be bundled up in my cabin. I'm hardly an invalid, Lyra says. You are a little. I don't need to face her to see that her eyes are burning through the air between us. Lyra has a way of looking at people, of looking at me, that can be felt as much as it can be seen. If her eyes weren't such a surprising shade of blue, I would swear that they were nothing more than hot coals from the fire within. I finger the Peggy's necklace, which hangs from my neck as Lyra's seashell hangs from hers. The key to everything. To ending a war that's lasted lifetimes. If you get shot, Lyra says, I'm going to treat you like you're incapable of doing the simplest tasks. She cradles her arms around her knees to keep out the cold. See how you like it when I hold out my arm to help you walk, even though you're not shot in the leg. I'd be flattered, I say, that you would look for an excuse just to hold my hand. Perhaps I'm just looking for an excuse to shoot you. I give her a sideways glance and recline on my elbows. The deck of the Sod is littered with my friends, splashing drink onto her varnished wood and singing songs that knock against her sails with the gusts. Seeing them this way, so happy and at ease, I know nothing could ever be thicker than the ocean that binds us. Not even blood. Madrid said that you are going to hand Rycroft over when we get to Pagos. There's been a price on his head for some time now, I say. But the services of the Zapra were too valuable for any kingdom to warrant attacking them. Now that the shadows have been decimated by us, I don't doubt he'll be a wanted man. If nothing else, it'll be some extra sway to make sure the Piggy's king grants us access to their mountain, so we can get the crystal and finish this whole thing. Lyra leans back so that we are level. Her hair is more unruly than ever, and the wind from the approaching storm does nothing to help. It blows into her eyes and catches across her lips, clinging to the freckles of her pale cheeks. I clench my hands by my sides, resisting the impulse to reach over and push it from her face. Do you really hate the sirens that much? She asks. They kill our kind. And you kill theirs. My eyebrows pinch together. That's different, I say. We do what we do to survive. They do it because they want to see us all dead. So it's revenge, then. It's retribution. I sit up a little straighter. It's not as though the sirens can be reasoned with. We can't just sign a peace treaty like with the other kingdoms. Why not? The distance in Lyra's voice gives me pause. The answer should come quick and easy. Because they're monsters, because they're killers, because of 1,000 reasons. But I don't say any of them. Truthfully, the idea of this not ending in death never crossed my mind. Of all the outcomes and possibilities I considered, peace wasn't one. If I had the opportunity, would I take it? Lyra doesn't look at me, and I hate that I can't figure out the expression on her face. Why are you questioning this? I ask. I thought the Sea Queen took everything from you, and you wanted to use the Crystal of Quito to end the war. You want revenge for your family as much as I do for Christian. Christian? Lyra looks at me now, and when she says his name, it freezes in the air between us. He was the Prince of Adekaros. I run a hand through my hair, feeling suddenly angry and unfocused. For a man like Christian to die, while a man like Talus Rycroft gets to live, is more than unjust. Lyra swallows. You were friends. Her voice sounds wretched and it distracts me. I can't remember her voice ever sounding anything short of pissed off. What was he like? She asks. There are countless words I could use to describe Christian. But a man's character is better seen in his actions than the laments of his loved ones. Christian was full of proverbs and sentiments I never understood and enjoyed mocking as much as I enjoyed hearing them. There wasn't a situation we found ourselves in that Christian didn't think warranted an adage. Love and madness are two stars in the same sky. You cannot build a roof to keep out last year's rain. He always had something ready to settle the rampant parts of me. I think of what Christian would say now, if he knew what I was planning. Any other man would want revenge, but I know he wouldn't see the crystal as a weapon. He wouldn't even want me to find it. If your only instrument is a sword, then you will always strike at your problems. Instead of telling all this to Lyra, I clasp the piggy's necklace and say, "Do you think she'll feel it?" "Who?" "The Princess Bane," I say. "Do you think she'll feel it when the Sea Queen dies?" Lyra lets out a sigh that turns to smoke on her lips. The air is thin and perilous. Wind cuts between us like daggers while a storm rumbles closer. I can smell the rain before it's here, and I know within moments the sky will come weeping down on us. Still, I don't move. The night flashes and groans, thick clouds creeping toward one another and merging into an infinite shadow that blocks the stars. It grows darker with each moment. "I wonder if she can feel anything at all," Lyra says. She shifts, and when she turns to me, her eyes are vacant. "I suppose we won't need to wonder for long."
32. Lyra. That night I dream of death. Seas run red with blood, and human bodies drift along the foam of my fallen kin. When the waves finally ladder high enough to stroke the night, they collapse, and the bodies mangle against the seabed. The sand bursts beneath them, scattering my kingdom in golden flakes. Amid it all, my mother's trident liquefies. I call out to her, but I'm not part of this great ocean anymore, and so she doesn't hear me. She doesn't see me. She doesn't know that I'm watching her downfall. She lets the trident wither and melt. Elian stands beside her, and the newly sunlit water parts for him. He has eyes like vast pools, and a jaw made from shipwrecks and broken coral. Every movement he makes is as quick and fluid as a tidal wave. He belongs to the ocean. He is made from it, as much as I am. Kindred. Elian stares at the seabed. I want to ask him why he's so fascinated by sand, when there is an entire world in this ocean that he can't begin to imagine. Why isn't he seeing it? Why doesn't he care enough to look? I've seen the world through his eyes. Can't he see it through mine? The urge to scream rips through me. But I can only remember the words in Sarin, and I don't dare speak the language to him. I watch him turn toward the sand, his face as plainly broken as my mother's. It's only when I'm certain I might lose my mind from the anguish that I suddenly remember his language. I sift quickly through the Mydassan and find the words to tell him. I want to explain how full of magic and possibility my world could be if not for my mother's rule. I want to comfort him with a chance for peace, no matter how small. Tell him things could be different if I were queen, that I wasn't born a murderer. But I find the words too late. By the time they become clear in my mind, I see the truth of what Elian sees. He is not staring at the sand at all, but at the hearts that rupture from it. "Don't look. Don't look." "Did you do it?" Elian's eyes find mine. "Did you do it?" he asks again in Sarin. The razors of my language are enough to cut through his tongue, and I wince as blood slips from his mouth. "I took many hearts," I confess. "His was last." Elian shakes his head. And the laugh that escapes his lips is a perfect echo of my mother's. "No," he tells me. "It wasn't." He stretches his hands out and I stumble backward in horror. I'm no longer in control when my legs buckle and throw me to the floor. I look at the heart in Elian's hands, blood gathering between his fingertips.
Not just any heart. His own.
Is this what you were after?
He screams. He takes a step forward and I shake my head, warning him not to come closer.
Lyra, Elian whispers. Isn't this what you wanted?
I wake up, gasping for air. My hands clutch the thin white bedsheet, and my hair slavers over my bare shoulders. The ship rocks slowly to the side, but the motion that I used to find comforting makes me more nauseated by the second. My heart ticks madly against my chest, shaking more than beating. When I unclench my fists from the bedsheet, there are scratch marks on my palm, angry red streaks across the lines of my hand. No matter how hard I try, I can't seem to catch my breath. The image of Elian's heart plays on an unsteady loop. The betrayal in his eyes. The punishing sound of my mother's laughter. I spent my life hiding from the possibility of being different than what my mother told me I must be. Swallowing the child with a desire to become something else. I was a siren, and so I was a killer. It was never wrong or right. It just was. But now my memories are cruel dreams, twisting into merciless visions and accusing me of a past I can't deny. The truth of what I am has become a nightmare.
33. Elian. The water is slush by the time the sod makes her birth. Cold has a faithful presence here, and with dusk rapidly approaching, the air seems almost frozen by the impending absence of sun. Regardless, it's just as bright as if it were morning. The mirror of the frozen sky against the white water, flecked by tufts of ice and snow, makes for a kingdom that is beautifully void of darkness. Even in the dead of night, the sky turns no darker than a mottled blue, and the ground itself acts like a light to guide the way. Snow, reflecting the eternal tinsel of the stars. Pagos. I feel the beat of the necklace against my heart as we step foot onto the snow. Finally, the crystal is within reach. I have the key and the map to navigate the route, and all that's left is for Lyra to tell me the secrets of the ritual. The air is crisp on my skin, and though my hands are wrapped under thick gloves, I shove my fists into my pockets anyway. The wind penetrates here through every layer, including skin. I'm dressed in fur so thick that walking feels like an exertion. It slows me down more than I would like. And even though I know there's no imminent threat of attack, I still don't like being unprepared in case one comes. It shakes me more than the cold ever could. When I turn to Lyra, the ends of her hair are white with frost. Try not to breathe, I tell her. It might get stuck halfway out. Lyra flicks up her hood. You should try not to talk then, she retorts. Nobody wants your words being preserved for eternity. They're pearls of wisdom, actually. I can barely see Lyra's eyes under the mass of dark fur from her coat. But the mirthless curl of her smile is ever present. It lingers in calculated amusement as she considers what to say next, readies to ricochet the next blow. Lyra pulls a line of ice from her hair, artfully indifferent. If that is what pearls are worth these days, I'll make sure to invest in diamonds. Or gold, I tell her smugly. I hear it's worth its weight. Kai shakes the snow from his sword and scoffs. Anytime you two want to stop making me feel nauseated, go right ahead.
Are you jealous because I'm not flirting with you?
Madrid asks him, warming her finger on the trigger mechanism of her gun. I don't need you to flirt with me, he says. I already know you find me irresistible. Madrid reholsters her gun. It's actually quite easy to resist you when you're dressed like that. Kai looks down at the sleek red coat fitted snugly to his lithe frame. The fur coat cuddles against his jaw and obscures the bottoms of his ears, making it seem as though he has no neck at all. He throws Madrid a smile. Is it because you think I look sexier wearing nothing? Torek lets out a withering sigh and pinches the bridge of his nose. I'm not sure whether it's from the hours we've gone without food or his inability to wear cutoffs in the biting cold, but his patience seems to be wearing thin.
I could swear that I'm on a life-and-death mission with a bunch of lusty kids, he says. Next thing I know, the lot of you will be writing love notes in rum bottles.
Okay, Madrid says. Now I feel nauseated. I laugh, but the sound is lost against the rhythm of nomadic drum beats that barrel toward us. Up ahead, a line of warriors approach. There's at least a dozen of them, standing in a perfect military arrow, marching fiercely in our direction. Even with the blizzard, they're easy to spot. The snow does a poor job of obscuring their imposing statures and impressively systematic formation. They hike seamlessly in step with one another, feet crushing into the snow with the pound of every drumbeat. They look like giants. Their uniforms so dark they ink the empty landscape. When they reach us, there's a momentary silence while we consider one another. Even with the layers of fur and armor, it's not hard to tell the royals from the soldiers. The four members of the Peguise family stand like titans, magnificent hunters' headdresses swooping down their backs in glorious coats. Their eyes peer through the jaws of their respective animals. Polar bear, Arctic fox, wilderness wolf, and in the middle of the warriors and his brothers, the snow lion. Each animal is a glorious shade of white that melts into the snow by their feet. It's a stark contrast to their black armor and weaponry. Spears and swords that are all the darkest shade of ebony. They gleam in a way that's almost liquid. The Peggy's brothers pull back the animal skins, shielding them from the cold. As expected, King Kazu is the snow lion. The most deadly of all creatures. Though it stands taller than some men, the Peguise king seems to encompass the creature's size perfectly. He doesn't look at all dwarfed by the mammoth carcass.
Prince Elion, Kazu greets.
His skin is so white it's almost blue. His lips mingle with the rest of his face like a variant shade, and everything about him is as sharp as it is straight. His eyes are severe points that arch to the end of his brows, and his hair is made from rays of sword-like strands that scrape against his weaponry. Kazu brings his hand to his stomach and leans forward in a customary bow. His brothers follow suit, while the guardians around them stand firmly upright. In Pagos, it's not customary for soldiers to bow to royalty. It's a greeting made only from one elite to another, and soldiers must stay still and impartial, unnoticed until they're acknowledged. Your Royal Highness, I say, returning the greeting. I'd like to thank you for receiving us into your kingdom. It's an honor to be welcomed here. I turn to the princes. Their headdresses matched according to their age and so according to their right to the throne. The second eldest, Prince Hiroki, is the polar bear. Tetsu, the wilderness wolf. And the youngest prince, Koji, is the Arctic fox. I formally greet them and they bow in turn. I wonder which of them is Rycroft's naive little source.
Of course, but it's not just my brothers who welcome you, Kazu says, but our entire family.
He waves his hand behind him, and a new figure emerges from the soldiers, dressed as gloriously as the royal family. A fifth, standing shorter and with a far less military posture, but a similar sense of indignation. I don't need the unprecedented addition to pull back the animal skin to know who it is. Sakura smiles when she sees my face tick, bright blue lips matching the ungodly color of the sky. Her hair is shorter than before, with a fringe cut bluntly to hide the tips of her eyes. A heavy bronze chain sweeps down from her forehead to a white bone piercing on her left earlobe. She doesn't look like a princess.